Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Last week on the show, I talked with Columbia professor Carl Hart about the research in his book, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. Hart's work challenges much of what passes for conventional wisdom about drugs, drug users, and addiction. And rooted in hard-headed evidence, Hart supports the decriminalization of drugs. This week, in the second of what I guess is a two-part series, I'll be joined by Doug Fine to talk about the accelerating movement to change the rules on marijuana. According to Fine, as the economy continues to limp along for most Americans and California cities declare bankruptcy, one action, the legalization of marijuana, would save government billions per year while raising huge sums in taxes. According to Time, the legal medicinal cannabis economy already generates $200 million annually in taxable proceeds from a mere 500,000 registered medical users in just 16 states. 51% of Americans support full legalization, cannabis regulated for adults like alcohol, and 80% support medicinal cannabis legalization. Fine's book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution, is just out in paperback. And in a postscript that he added to the new edition, Fine writes, I'm going to read a quote here, on November 6, 2012, Colorado and Washington voters ended the drug war. That is to say, voters in both states overwhelmingly legalized adult social use of cannabis. Colorado's new law, vitally, also allows industrial cannabis cultivation. It's no stretch to say that the Berlin Wall of the drug war has fallen. We're going to talk about how quickly the landscape is changing and look ahead to the era of legal marijuana. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Doug Fine is a journalist and a humorist, National Public Radio adventure contributor, author of Farewell My Subaru, An Epic Adventure in Local Living, Not Really an Alaskan Mountain Man, and his latest, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. Welcome again, Doug Fine, to Free Forum.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Terrence. So much has changed since we last spoke.
That's right. We spoke, I believe it was July 2012, so a little less than a year, but it has been quite a year, obviously the Colorado and Washington votes being the biggest signs. Before we get into what's changed and where we stand and where we're heading, I like listeners, as you know, to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So could you tell us in your own words a bit about your path to the kind of work you do today? And feel free to mention mentors or turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing. And by that, I mean, you know, you became a writer, you became sort of an idiosyncratic writer that looks for these interesting projects. And now you are called upon and taking a role sort of in this marijuana, where do we stand, where are we going kind of conversation. Go ahead.
Right. So I appreciate that. I appreciate the opportunity to give background. What a kind of rare treat in today's soundbite world. So I grew up in the New York suburbs, and I always felt as though the indigenous gene was in me. And that's what I wrote about, the indigenous gene in that first book, the aptly named Not Really an Alaskan Mountain Man. And, you know, it went right from McDonald's value meals to, you know, moose and salmon. From there, I wanted to reduce the hypocrisy inherent in, I guess anybody's journey, but in my journey, for instance, I was catching salmon in Alaska using a two-stroke outboard engine. I relocated to New Mexico, figuring correctly, actually, that you could point your solar panels down to the ground and still power your homestead. And I've been living pretty much on solar power, driving on vegetable oil, that kind of life for the last 7 years, and it's been intense just in the last week or two. We've had a ho-hum, another climate change, massive wildfire, now up to 45,000 acres and closing in on my Funky Butte Ranch here in New Mexico. It's changed our lives. The fire has caused a couple of bears to become fire refugees, and they slaughtered three of our four goats here just 2 days ago to provide my family's protein with their milk and yogurt. So we're going through some intense and profound changes here. All the humans in my family are okay, and we'll have plenty of warning if we actually do need to leave. But it's been, you know, really intense over these last few days. As far as drug policy goes, what caused me to write my follow-up book to Farewell My Subaru, which documents getting about 90% of the petroleum out of my life, the reason I wrote Too High to Fail and wrote about drug policy was because my next-door neighbor, closest neighbor, probably barely in shouting distance, is a AARP member, retiree, and he was raided on a tip from a neighbor in a multi, or tip from I don't know whom actually, in a multi-million dollar taxpayer wasting, you know, aerial raid that terrified me. I thought I was in trouble for some petition, you know, petition I had signed against fracking or something, but they weren't after me. They were after him for his, whatever it was, the dozen cannabis plants he used to self-medicate prior to the implementation of New Mexico's successful medical cannabis state program. And it was just a horrible waste of money and brought automatic weapons into my creek bed, not cartels, law enforcement brought automatic weapons into my creek bed, putting my family at risk. And I realized I had to write about it. And it's been the easiest thing I've ever had to write about. Writing about the drug war, if you look at it from the front lines, is like, you know, I'm sorry to give a violent image, but it's like shooting an elephant in a room. It's so wrong at core. It's one of America's worst policies, up there with terrible mistakes and what I believe a great country has made. And luckily, as you pointed out in your very excellent intro, it's on its way out. And I'll quick point on that. A few days ago, the U.S. House of Representatives in the Farm Bill approved by a 25-vote margin legalizing hemp. The Farm Bill itself failed. But to me, the news is what a non-news issue it was, that effectively the drug war, the war on marijuana is over. The House of Representatives voted to legalize hemp and against huge DEA objections, and nobody's, you know, carrying torches to bust the Democrats or the Republicans that supported this common sense vote. So that's proof positive to me that finally America's longest and most expensive war is just about over.
Okay, thanks a lot, Doug Fine. That's Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail. For people who issue of industrial hemp is a new one, now people have probably seen, you know, there's hemp clothes, there's hemp protein bars and so on. But give people a bit of background on that. And then if you will, I would imagine you were watching how that passage of that piece of the Farm Bill was moved toward passage in the House. So what's up with industrial hemp and how did that happen?
It's all amazing. It's a great question too. So industrial cannabis, this is, I have to really have the facts, you know, on the tip of my tongue because I'm sounding like, you know, all of our roommates that have the lava lamp and peace signs and hemp's going to save the world. But I'm just back from several months of research, including going to Manitoba, Canada, Canadian prairie in the middle of winter, which I wasn't, you know, wasn't my prime location choice for a journalistic site, but I had to because Canada's got a $500 million market that we buy, Americans buy 90% of, and it's growing 20% per year. And I had to look into it. I also, luckily, I got to research it a little bit in Hawaii as well, which is kind of on the forefront of reintroducing hemp. Interestingly, because they need it not just as a biofuel, but for animal feed. They don't have a good source of animal feed, and they've got an issue with importing protein for meat eaters in Hawaii. So I speak with confidence when I say I believe, not just I believe, but my research has turned up, that industrial cannabis or hemp is going to wind up being bigger even than the $40 billion a year economy that Harvard's Jeffrey Miron predicts psychoactive, you know, smoked cannabis will be. And some of the uses that surprised me beyond the food market that you mentioned, which is big. I mean, we put hemp oil in our family shake every morning. But energy is really huge. There's a company in Kentucky called Patriot Biofuels. These are not liberals. They have proposed putting, and Kentucky has legalized hemp contingent upon the federal legalization. Replanting hemp on marginal soil that's been damaged by coal mining, putting out of work farmers, tobacco farmers, and coal miners back on the land growing cannabis to then use in a process called gasification, which can be used to provide power in power plants very efficiently, I might add, and not taking away from food the way that energy, ethanol crops made from corn and soy do. So I think energy is going to be a huge part in energy independence for the country, as well as the massive hemp economy. And that's just one example. I could give many more, Terrence. One amazing thing I saw in Canada was a tractor entirely made from hemp. Like, you bang on the hood, and the tractor is made from hemp fiber, which actually is a tensile strength stronger than steel. So this surprised me until I learned that already BMW and Dodge use hemp fibers in door paneling today. So what an obscene absurdity it is that American farmers in North Dakota, Kentucky, California, and elsewhere aren't allowed to grow this plant, and that's going to be wrapping up very soon. Quick postscript here, when you were asking about my background, one of the big items I try to hit on here when we're talking about this now very realistic post-drug war economy is sustainability. As a guy who tries to live without petroleum, or largely without petroleum, if we're going to grow cannabis, whether it's psychoactive or industrial, it has to be done outdoors primarily when possible and sustainably. And that's important because indoor cannabis use is often heavy with pesticides and heavily energy demanding. So I just wanted to get that in there, that the same people who go to the farmer's market or belong to a community-supported agriculture farm and think about every nutrient they put on their body, if they're also among 100 million, America's 100 million cannabis aficionados, they really need to think about the sourcing and use their consumer dollar after the drug war ends to make sure that this industry is birthed sustainably.
Very good. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Doug Fine about marijuana and what's happening very rapidly in America's attitudes and laws regarding marijuana. His book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution, is just out in paperback. And you can learn more at Doug Fine, one word, DougFine.com. One other thing I wanted to add, and your one thing. If you have to go to Manitoba, it's not bad that you also have to go to Hawaii. I happen to hear that. Yeah, that sort of balances out. And also, I want you to tell people how important the hemp industry was in America before it was wrongly and absurdly barred because of fear of cannabis as a psychoactive plant.
Yeah, these talking points that you hear about that sound like they're out of the handbook, again, of somebody wearing a tie-dye protesting in front of the state house in Sacramento or something, but they're true. Thomas Jefferson really did write the draft of the Declaration of Independence on hemp. It really was required of early colonists that they grow it in Virginia. It really was as good as currency used for paying property taxes in the early ages of the United States. It really was, even as late as the 1898 U.S. Agriculture Annual Report, described as an immensely profitable and valuable crop. After the drug war mania started, really just to keep the jobs of the alcohol prohibition people when alcohol prohibition ended, the same dude that ran alcohol prohibition was the first head of the Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger. Even after that happened in 1937, in 1942, yes, you can go to YouTube and check it out. The Agriculture Department put out a wartime propaganda film called Hemp for Victory, urging Americans to grow absolutely vital crop for the war effort, especially for Navy rope and the parachutes that saved George Bush Sr. when he had to bail out of his plane. So all of those kind of talking points that you hear, they're true.
Okay. Let me also ask you again, before we get into some of the update, a bit about, because it plays both in the current situation and where we're heading, what you found when you spent a year in the Mendocino area of California, living there, researching and working on Too High to Fail. It seems, as you describe it, it's like as Mendocino functions in some alternate reality as if the war on drugs has ended, and just how they've sort of how they operate. What's going on up there?
That's a really good way of putting it, because the entire local government, including the sheriff, the twice elected and very popular registered Republican sheriff Tom Allman, put his career on the line. They all did, in some cases, freedom on the line, because the feds threatened them with arrest. At one point, I know in Tuatha Fail, the sheriff sent me an email saying, "Oh my gosh, if they come for me, will you bail me out?" And the reason for that is they had to. It was a matter of economic necessity. They became the laboratory that proves that the drug peace era, this big economy we're going to see when the drug war ends, that it really works. I think something like 80% of Americans call the drug war a complete failure, but that doesn't mean that alternatives of the future would necessarily be magically wonderful. But Mendocino proved and showed a model that actually is amazingly wonderful. And I'll give you the quote of a former drug warrior up there and what he said about it. But first, to describe what they did. And this is really the primary focus of Too High to Fail, although I expanded to kind of a worldwide outlook. What Mendocino did was Sheriff Allman was told he had to fire 7 deputy sheriffs, which is something like, I can't remember what it is now, 18% of his force. They hadn't hired a new sheriff, an extra sheriff, since 1972. So he was very concerned about real public safety issues on the ground. As he put it to me, the county has big problems, meth, domestic violence, and poverty. Cannabis isn't even in the top 10, right? So this was his words, the sheriff, the chief law enforcement. So he went and told the Board of Supervisors, the county Board of Supervisors, we've got to acknowledge the T-Rex in the room. Let me permit farmers, cannabis farmers, and those fees will save those 7 deputy jobs. It'll raise $500,000. They laughed him out of the room, but said, go ahead and try. And he staked his career on it. And it didn't raise $500,000, it raised $600,000. 99 brave farmers in the year that I followed, 2011, came above ground. And what was really remarkable about the program to me was the sustainability guidelines written into it. Because, again, I'm becoming this sort of preacher for sustainably grown everything, really. I mean, that's what I do. I live a sustainable life. I'm not a cannabis farmer, at least not yet, not until federal prohibition ends, because I've got little kids and I don't want helicopters raiding with guns. The outdoor requirements, the zoning requirements, no artificial pesticides allowed, water resource uses, and those standards were increasingly developing. It was such a remarkably wonderful program. They called it the Zip Tie Program, because all of the 99 plants that a farm was allowed to grow would have these yellow bracelets on them, and that prevented state and local raids, as unfortunately the sad part of the book shows, it didn't prevent federal raids. But it was an absolute landmark program that all the counties in the Emerald Triangle were going to emulate if the feds hadn't absurdly and outrageously interfered with it. So it was an unmitigated success. And in the end, besides the money raised, the deputy position saved, this is what Randy Johnson, the fellow who administered the Zip Tie program for Sheriff Allman, told me. This guy said, 3 years ago, if I saw you with a joint, I threw you in jail. I took the joint, put it in the evidence room. I didn't think anything more of it. That's what I thought cannabis was. Now I see these are just great farmers, right? These are just people, part of our community, doing the thing. But more than that, the reason why the Zip Tie program was important was he, Randy said, was getting for the first time in his whatever 27-year career phone calls requesting help on things like domestic violence and home invasion, whereas in the past, the cannabis community had to live in an underground way, and so these crimes were going unreported because people were afraid if they reported, let's say, a domestic violence incident, the deputies would be more interested in their cannabis garden. And let me tell you, just about everybody up there is a cannabis farmer. I mean, just about anybody. They call it the phone book. That's how you find out who the cannabis farmers are. Just open the phone book. Sheriff Allman said on his first overflight of the county as sheriff, he said, so that's how that conservative Republican pays for 2 Stanford tuitions at once. You know, everybody up there grows cannabis. And so people are now coming above ground and able to participate in the community. And Randy Johnson, the program's administrator, said that was the biggest value. The fact that there's an entire segment of the society now, which is 90% of the economy up there, by the way, is now above ground, law-abiding and tax-paying. And how dare, I'd like to add, the feds interfere with that when there's cartels out there. It's outrageous.
Okay, that's the voice of Doug Fine. We're talking about what's going on with cannabis and marijuana in America today. And his book, just out in paperback, is Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. His website is DougFine.com. It's interesting. What I heard in that is also something similar to what happens with people who fear immigration laws. That same thing, that when you make a person's identity illegal, they're afraid to report crime, they're afraid to report domestic abuse, et cetera, et cetera.
That immigration example is a great one for a couple of reasons, Terrence, too. When the feds came in and kind of handpicked these law-abiding local chamber of commerce member, environmentally sustainable, job-creating, cartel-herding, locavore, organic-style farmers, and rated them as people who read Too High to Fail, we'll see happen. One of the excuses I hear is, well, what do you expect? We have to do it. It's federal law. Really? Because on the way there to enforce that federal law, you pass every grape farm along the way where, of course, equally absurd federal labor laws are being violated. So that was one example. And the other issue with immigration, people that are scared of immigration reform, that we'll say is they're afraid of these terrible consequences. But what the Mendocino experiment with cannabis and ending the drug war showed is actually society gets better. There is nobody up there, just about nobody. I mean, we're talking high 90% of the Mendocino County population that feels that the program was a success. To state that more succinctly and clearly, it was such a success up there that even people who are not big supporters of cannabis saw that this is the right side of history, and that includes members of the Board of Supervisors who originally laughed at Sheriff Tom Allman's efforts to bring the number one industry above ground.
Right. And the other thing that's similar about both cases, immigration and the war on drugs, and specifically marijuana, is that this crazy idea of labeling huge numbers as illegal or practicing something illegal, there's something you have to see about that if you're on the side of law or law enforcement, that at a certain percentage, reality or the norms of society transcends your idea of what's legal and what's illegal.
And the thing is, even if you philosophically make that realization, Terrence, the problem is that many law enforcement budgets, and I say this as a law enforcement supporter, I acknowledge the fact that in society one requires law enforcement, and those that are honest and good and do their job diligently, as most do, have my support. So this is not a sort of a cop-bashing statement. But the fact is, ask Norm Stamper, former Seattle police chief, and various other assistant chief, former chiefs of L.A. PD who are a part of law enforcement against Prohibition, LEAP, an organization worth looking into for listeners. What they will tell you is that many law enforcement budgets have become dependent on drug war funding, seizing, it's parasitic, seizing American property, shuffling people through the prison industrial complex. And I went to many courtrooms and covered that at length in Too High to Fail. So what you're seeing is budgets that are actually dependent upon arresting people for what probably, or not probably, almost certainly in their heart, the arresting officer knows is not just policy and that it absolutely has to change.
Okay. You were one of the things that you point out in a recent blog entry that indicates to you that things are changing is that on June 7th, you had an article in the Washington Post, Five Myths About Legalizing Marijuana. Why don't we go through those five myths, just because as I looked at them, I thought that's we've talked a little bit about some of them, but that's a good handle sort of on what's going on. So number one, first, did they approach you or did you approach them?
They approached me, which is you really asked a good question. It matters. The Washington Post, I mean, that is as establishment and beltway as you can get. They were on board and said in as many words, it's time to end this thing. Go for it.
Great. Okay, so myth number one, if pot is legal, more people will use it.
You know, what I hear, the talking point when I debate drug warriors, sometimes people feel like in the name of balance, they have to have like these paid with our taxpayer dollars, paid liars to come on and lie about drug issues. And what they do is they sort of announce and twist statistics about things. The short answer on use is that it may, some studies, you know, in places like Portugal and Amsterdam that have legalized cannabis or all drugs, some show initial declines in use, some show initial increases, but on all counts, just about every study, if not every study that I've seen, slight on all counts. So it's not like this scare tactic of we're going to have kids going to kindergarten with carrying joints. Now, kids is another example. The one that that one of the last few of these kind of paid drug warriors, a former kind of assistant to the drug czar guy that now is going around, you know, making his living lying about stuff. What he threw at me last time we went toe-to-toe, I think it was on CNBC or something, was a study that came out showing that regular underage cannabis users show whatever it was, a 6% IQ decrease. Now, talk about missing the point. The real point is a Brown University study and multiple others, including one that just came out recently, but one that I'm very familiar with, the Brown University study, came out, studied thousands of kids in New England and found that, in fact, there's a slight decrease in youth use rates in states like Rhode Island that have legalized medical cannabis. And incidentally, what the drug warriors said to me when I made that point was, oh, that study wasn't peer reviewed. So Brown University, an Ivy League school, wasn't good enough for him. But the bottom line is, you know, we're not going to see immediately huge increases or decreases. Two other quick points, if I can. I don't want to ramble too long, but yeah. Two quick other points on that. One is criminals don't ask for ID, and that's why youth rates are at their highest rates ever now, which the Justice Department acknowledges in all their annual narcotics reports. It can't get any worse in terms of youth rates. It can only get better. And the other thing I want to mention in terms of youth, in terms of adult use rates, and I think there are studies underway about this already in Colorado, is that we may actually see public health benefits from people substituting cannabis for alcohol in social situations. It makes for safer roads. It makes for less violence. I mean, ask any law enforcer whether they'd rather get a call of marijuana use in progress or violent drunk in a home, right? Any day they take the cannabis call. And so we're potentially seeing positive social effects of substitution of cannabis for alcohol. Now, I'm not recommending intoxication in general. You know, I'm a big believer in trying to get high on life. But if you're talking about occasional responsible adult use, any day, cannabis is safer than alcohol.
Right. Okay, let me read you a couple of things. One, Tony Newman in the Huffington Post recently talking about Portugal. Portugal decriminalized drugs in 2001. And since then, drug use has not increased, while addiction, overdose, HIV transmission, and incarceration have declined dramatically. And the Drug Policy Alliance has a fact sheet, Approaches to Decriminalizing Drug Use and Possession, on their website, drugpolicy.org. In your Washington Post article, you said that a 2011 University of California, Berkeley study showed a slight increase in adult use with de facto legalization in the Netherlands. Yet that study and one in 2009 found Dutch rates slightly lower than the European average. So there's for people who are worried about that particular myth. Okay, the next myth, law enforcement officials wait a second. We're right at the halfway mark. Let me tell people. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Doug Fine. We're talking about marijuana and the drug war. His book, Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution, is just out in paperback. And to learn more, you can go to DougFine.com. Okay, we're going through the five myths that Doug Fine wrote about in an article requested by the Washington Post that was published June 7th. And the second myth is that law enforcement officials oppose legalization. You mentioned LEAP, L-E-A-P, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and I believe their website is leap.org, and it is it's a revelation to someone who hasn't looked into this. But go ahead. Myth number two, law enforcement officials oppose legalization.
Yeah, so Sheriff Tom Allman in Mendocino County, California, no liberal, told me, I think it was in our first interview, it might have been our second, we were sitting in his office, beautiful Emerald Hills outside the window in Mendocino, California, and he said, I'm not sure I'm getting across my point about how unworried I am about cannabis. Let me tell you, if somebody was just walking outside this window right now, and these are his words, if somebody were walking outside my window right now carrying a pound under their arm, I would not get off my ass to do anything about it. He just does not feel that it's a crime, and almost every law enforcer realizes this. But it is the gravy train, and there are many law enforcement agencies are addicted to it, Terrence, as we talked about in the first half of the program. And I got a taste of that when I first was researching in Mendocino County, California. One of the first times I left the county after relocating there for the year, as I did for the 2011 growing season to write Too High to Fail, I bumped out of the county and was hardly back down in Sonoma County, incidentally, under a billboard reading Grab Some Buds, a Budweiser billboard, when I was profiled, as a male, youngish male with a beard in a truck coming out of Mendocino County, and pulled over by a drug squad, falsely told that my car truck smelled like cannabis. It was, it was false. Not read any rights. First time ever in the wrong side of a police car, in the back seat of a police car, while my truck was pilfered. And I knew it was great research for the book, although it's very scary to have that happen, to have men and guns put you into the back of a, lock you in the back of a car. But I did the calculations on how much taxpayer dollars are spent on that corridor. They call it the gauntlet, the growers in the Emerald Triangle, because they have to get through Sonoma County and into the relative safety of the Bay Area to deliver medicine to the legitimate market, or these days what's still the black market. And I cost them, in their 20 minutes of fruitlessly pulling apart my kids' car seats and all that jazz, I cost them something like American taxpayers something like $1,500, I think it was. Maybe it was $15,000. I can't remember what it was, but some significant amount of money that's recorded in the book. Not for a second did those law enforcers think they were ending the drug war or winning some kind of battle. They were generating revenue for their department. That was their gig that day.
Okay. And myth number three, getting high would be the top revenue generator for the cannabis plant. We won't talk about this one because we've already talked about this, that you believe that while that might be the case at first, that in the long run, the hemp industry, that the plant from which we – one thing, explain the difference between hemp and psychoactive cannabis.
Sure. I mean, they're completely different, and no other country in the world has this problem. The DEA's memo, their lobbying memo to try to stop the legalization of hemp, which worked in the Senate debate for the Farm Bill 2 weeks ago, but did not work in the House, thank God, and now probably wouldn't work in the Senate another time, makes these absurd claims that law enforcement wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Or people wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It's a night and day thing. I think about it in terms of football players. Apologies for people who aren't sports fans. But the hemp, industrial cannabis, is like the lineman. It's the workforce. It's thousands of plants grown right next to each other, huge, vast acreages of a tall, thin plant that's grown for its fiber, and nothing happens if you smoke it. Psychoactive cannabis is like the wide receiver. It's kind of a prima donna. It's manicured. It has beautiful flowers on it, because the flowers are the psychoactive element, or the medicinal element as well, or the spiritual element, if you like it, or the health maintenance side of it. There's no confusing it. As I said, I do this extensive research in Canada and ask these questions. I asked it of the person in charge of testing the Manitoba crop, which is growing, as I said, 20 to 30% per year, because we Americans buy it, by the way. We buy 90% of it. Andrea Herman is her name, and I said, any confusion? She said, not once in 15 years has there been a case of confusion.
Okay, so they are the same plant, but two different strains, if you will?
I would say, yeah, even more than that. So, yes, that's a fairly good way of putting it. Technically, it's the same species. The two most prominent psychoactive varieties are Cannabis sativa, which comes from the tropics, Cannabis indica, which comes from the highlands of Asia. The most commercially cultivated psychoactive strains these days are hybrids of those two, sativa and indica. Cannabis ruderalis is the other main branch that's generally non-psychoactive. It has essentially negligible THC and looks and grows much, much differently. And you'd never confuse them.
Very good. Okay, myth number four, Doug Fine. Big tobacco and big alcohol would control the legal cannabis industry.
This is a really interesting one. So you have this discussion amongst third generation Emerald Triangle farmers who, at first, when you say, well, you know, it looks like we're winning, we Americans are winning the drug war, are you going to come above ground? They said, winning the drug war? I call, you know, putting my kids through college winning the drug war. There's this renegade band up there called the Camo Cowboys in the Emerald Triangle, and they have a song called The Flower Police that talks about the symbiotic relationship between law enforcement and growers, because it's law enforcement getting 1% of the crop, 1% of the farmers, and they'll never be convicted by local juries up there, by the way, seizing a crop, and that keeps the prices high just by keeping it black market, and it works for everyone. It keeps the law enforcement raid people with their jobs and their fancy gadgets and all that jazz, and the only people that lose are the American people, the Mexican people, the Afghan people, and people that suffer from drug war violence. And it's, you know, it's great for lawyers to keep the drug war cannabis illegal. But it's a thin veneer, the protest. And the protest that you hear is, oh my goodness, we'll be put out of business because Coors and or Marlboro will move in. Now,
Doug, let me just say that when on Prop 19, the California initiative to do some decriminalization, which failed in a close vote a couple of years ago, and there were strategic reasons probably for that they ran that proposition during a non-presidential election, so they had much smaller turnout. But the counties that make a good living off of the current situation, I believe both voted down the reform.
That's right. That's right. And there was another reason for that as well, which had to do that it was a little bit urban centric and indoor cultivation centric.
Okay.
Prop 19. But yeah, you're absolutely right in your analysis. And I think Californians will overwhelmingly legalize cannabis in 2016.
Yeah. This bugaboo that it'll be big tobacco, big alcohol, or big pharma that will control the industry.
And the fact is, Wall Street does what Wall Street does, for better or for worse. We can bash it all day long. We've gotten to where we've gotten today, living in a kind of Wall Street, you know, dominated world. And rather than bash it all day, I'm going to acknowledge that when it comes to cannabis, America's number one cash crop, Wall Street is going to do what it's going to do, whether it's pharmaceuticals. There's already been a public offering of a cannabis related crop tied to Bayer, German pharmaceutical companies, in America, in the United States, a few weeks ago. They're going to do what they're going to do, and the fact is, yes, after the drug war ends, if states regulate cannabis like alcohol, probably there will be a pack of the equivalent of Coors or Marlboro in the corner store. But there's a huge difference here. First of all, the top shelf cultivators, the people that are able to brand themselves as the Emerald Triangle farmers are, they have a group called emeraldgrowers.org, to name one group. There's a number of them. They're trying to brand cannabis the way that Napa did with wine. So sure, you can get $2 Chuck Cabernet in Trader Joe's, but fine wine aficionados are going to go to a fine wine store and get that. The craft beer market is another analog. It's something like a $9 billion a year industry, the craft beer market I'm talking about. Now, still, it's dwarfed by Coors, but to say that the high-end, very organically grown, well-marketed small farmer is going to be put out of business is simply wrong, especially since this industry is already decentralized and farmer-controlled today. If the people that are already among, you know, again, America's 100 million cannabis partakers continues to have that mindset when it's at the farmer's market or when it's at whatever it is, when it's at the food co-op, available at the food co-op for your healthy, you know, Sunday barbecue dip, they're going to seek something out the same way that they do organic butter, organic eggs, or organic broccoli. So it's not an either-or proposition, and it's going to be consumer-driven.
Right, which is, as you say, it's very much the case now with either alcohol or food, especially produce. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Doug Fine about the situation with marijuana, the evolving situation with marijuana. His book, Too High to Fail, is just out in paperback. Your fifth myth in the article in the June 7th Washington Post was, in the heartland, legalization is a political non-starter. And before I ask you to answer, let me read you what I thought was interesting. And this is a quote from Ethan Nadelman, the head of the Drug Policy Alliance, in a recent article in the Huffington Post. Washington and Colorado became the first two states in the country, and indeed the first political jurisdictions anywhere in the world, to approve legally regulating marijuana. These initiatives didn't just win. They won by decisive margins of nearly 10% in both states. The initiative in Colorado got more votes than Obama, while Washington's initiative got more votes than the winners of the statewide races for governor and attorney general. And the Washington initiative even won in several counties that were carried by Romney. So the myth, again, is in the heartland, legalization is a political non-starter.
This is the funnest part to watch for me, Terrence, because in essence, it's kind of revitalizing for me as a voter and a patriot and a citizen when, you, when you're kind of despairing and you see congressional dysfunctionality and the, you know, generally terrible Supreme Court we have right now. And you think, my gosh, all these checks and balances you learned about. Yeah, and as I should say, again, as a preface, as a journalist who's reported from five continents, I tend to be a little bit of an American apologist, because for all of our mistakes, you know, I've reported from Rwanda. We generally don't have death squads, and you don't die when you take a sip of water, you know. So there's great things about America, but, you know, just when I'm kind of losing hope, I live in a very conservative valley in New Mexico, and when the locals heard about what I'm writing about, they might think President Obama was born in Kenya, but they live in a border county, a border region of southern New Mexico, and they said, oh my God, when are we going to stop financing these cartels with a drug war? You know, it's they know everywhere you go, a majority of Kentuckians want to end the drug war. It's looking good for legalization in Ohio, in Missouri, and for obvious reasons. I mean, we're sitting here acting like we're surprised about this. 40% of Colorado Republicans, I don't know if you mentioned this when you're quoting Ethan, but 40% of Republicans in Colorado voted to legalize cannabis. You know, it's huge. And then here's another statistic. That's sort of conservative older voters. But here's something also that that politicos are paying a lot of attention to, and that is, since the 1972 election, the politicos and pundits have been wondering when the youth vote is going to make a difference. It certainly did not in 1972 when Nixon mopped the floor with McGovern. But this finally happened. In 2012, youth vote was up 6% in Colorado. This is over 2008 Yes We Can election. I'm not talking about over any kind of midterm. 6% youth vote up in Colorado, and 12% youth vote increase in Washington. And finally, the establishment, the election winners, you know, started noticing this, and that's why, in his very first opinion, interview after re-election, the big interview with Barbara Walters, finally President Obama answered a drug war question without giggling or anything else, and he said that he himself does not favor legalization yet, he said, but he's got bigger fish to fry than interfering with Colorado or Washington. Point being, everybody knows now that this is an issue that is across the board support. And I mean, again, we're sitting here spending minutes of our interview acting astounded that that common sense prevails, but it does. It prevails young and old, left and right, across the country.
Okay. That's the voice of Doug Fine. I'm going to read a few more things and then ask you another question, because I want to make sure I get some of these facts out. Again, this is from Ethan Nadelman, who's been a guest on this show several times over the years, and is one of, if you will, one of our great civil rights leaders because of his long time and finally emerging successful work with the Drug Policy Alliance. He says, this is from Ethan Nadelman's recent work, In 2009, just after Obama's initial election, his drug czar said, regardless of how you try to explain to people it's a war on drugs or a war on a product, people see a war as a war on them, and we are not at war with people in this country, and we're going to drop the notion of war on drugs. However, Nadelman again, the Obama administration's budget continues to emphasize enforcement, prosecution and incarceration at home, and interdiction, eradication, and military escalation abroad. And here's how many people are caught up in this drug war dragnet. In 2011, the last year for which data are available, more than 1.5 million people were arrested for a drug law violation in the U.S., 1.5 million, and more than 80% of those were for low-level possession. On any given night, roughly 500,000 people go to sleep behind bars in the U.S. for nothing more than a drug law violation, 10 times the number in 1980. More than half of all drug arrests are for marijuana, and more than 750,000 Americans were arrested for marijuana in 2011 alone, 86% for mere possession. So that's the scope of what still remains. And then on the good news side, the movements internationally have been profound. It's as if something that was pent up has finally shifted. This is Nadelman again. In 2009, former presidents Fernando Henrique Cardoso of Brazil, Cesar Gaviria of Colombia, and Ernesto Zedillo of Mexico, this is former presidents, joined with other members of the Latin American Commission on Drugs and Democracy in saying the time had come to break the taboo on exploring alternatives to the failed war on drugs. In 2011, those presidents joined with former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, former U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz, former Federal Reserve Board Chairman Paul Volcker, former Swiss President Ruth Dreyfus, and other members of the Global Commission on Drug Policy in calling for fundamental reforms to national and global drug policies. Former Presidents Jimmy Carter, Ricardo Lagos of Chile, Vicente Fox of Mexico, and Alexander Kwasniewski of Poland were among those who seconded the recommendations. Beginning in late 2011, current presidents began to join the calls of their predecessors. These included President Santos in Colombia, Otto Perez Molina in Guatemala, Mujica in Uruguay, and Felipe Calderon, who was then president of Mexico. Last month, the Organization of American States released a landmark report that envisions possible scenarios, including decriminalization, legalization, and other alternatives to prohibitionist policies for future drug control policy. That is what's happening on the international level. Give us, if you will, Doug Fine, what is happening kind of under the radar in terms of people who are preparing for, as you call it, the drug peace time instead of the drug war time. What's going on in terms of manufacture, alternative planning, and so on? For instance, what's going on in Colorado and Washington in terms of implementing what their voters voted on?
That's a great question, and I'll get to that in a quick second. I just want to comment. By the way, Drug Policy Alliance is doing some great work internationally as well. And I'm glad you made all those points. A couple of thoughts on that. One is President Obama was one of the people that commissioned that Organization of American States report that just came out.
Oh, interesting.
Consider options other than prohibition. And then on your other point about all the, you know, hundreds of thousands of arrests every year, most of them for possession, that's why it is absolutely so vital that cannabis be removed from the Controlled Substances Act entirely and states are allowed to regulate like alcohol. Because for all the rhetoric of we don't want to be fighting a war anymore coming out of the White House, bureaucracy doesn't know how to shut itself off unless the law changes and its budgetary tap is turned off.
That's right. If you want to talk about addiction, there's addiction for you.
Exactly. So that's why it's so important. Sometimes I'm asked, you know, you've written about sustainability, you've covered, you know, wars. Why do you care so much about the drug war? Is it that important that people be allowed to smoke a joint without going to jail? And the answer is it's fundamental. I mean, we're becoming a society that imprisons people for profit, and that's something that even Pat Robertson now speaks out against the televangelists. So as far as laying the groundwork and what's happening in Colorado and Washington, I'm really glad you asked that, because while in the end I think it will sort itself out, because, again, this is an industry that's had 40 years to develop. Michael Pollan calls cannabis farmers, the best farmers of his generation. These folks know what they're doing. They know how to run a business. And as soon as the federal government allows them to open bank accounts and pay taxes, they're going to be severely hurting the cartels and criminal organizations, just as bootleggers went away when alcohol prohibition went away. And so I'm paying close attention to, but not getting overly worried about the nuts and bolts of how Colorado and Washington are developed, except in a couple of key areas. And by the way, I should say there are probably people jumping up and down right now because there's a huge amount of conspiracy theories going on about meetings happening between the drug czar, White House Office of Drug Control Policy, and Colorado's governor and people related to Colorado's governor, because the Colorado's governor did make his money in alcohol, and he is an opponent of cannabis. He was not in favor of the constitutional amendment that voters overwhelmingly chose. And so there's all kinds of theories that it's kind of either throwing a wrench in it or trying to restrict it or favoring monster companies that are going to come in and get, you know, monopolistic kind of contracts. And citizens need to be paying attention to that kind of thing. But as a sustainability journalist, what I'm watching very carefully, and I'm deeply concerned about it in Colorado and just jumping for joy that Washington just yesterday, I got an email, is reconsidering, and that is an emphasis on indoor cultivation. It's extremely misguided. It's terrible for the earth. We can't make America's number one, what is already America's number one crop, be in a warehouse, not under God's sun, tons of pesticides, tons of energy use. There's been reports, including by a Nobel laureate, Evan Mills, about the amount of energy use that goes into indoor cannabis cultivation. The fact is, in certain climates, there might not, at certain times of year, there's no other way to do it. There are ways to mitigate the impact, but that's not even really being discussed. What people are worried about in mandating indoor growing, as Colorado is doing, and Washington initially looked like it was going to be doing, but they're reconsidering now, which is terrific. What they're worried about is things like, lures to neighborhood kids if there's not enough security, or smell nuisance, you drive through Gilroy, California, you smell garlic. Is that a nuisance? I don't know. I don't think so.
Not to the folks of Gilroy.
Right. So, bottom line, the groundwork is being laid, but I, for me, to cut through the mess, the things that are important to me is that the industry is allowed to develop sustainably, that people who want to home cultivate, as they would garlic or any other medicinal herb, let's say, echinacea or something, that people are allowed to always cultivate in their backyard. That makes you not have to worry about big business or indoor grows or any of that Marlboro Coors stuff. That's the second big thing. And the third thing is that small providers, people that want to be selling at a farmer's market or in a local food co-op are able to do that just as they would with broccoli. And if those things are, and those are big ifs, but if those things are allowed to unfold over time as each state regulates, I think we're going to be okay as the drug peace economy begins.
Okay. What I like, actually, as I was listening to that answer, Doug Fine, is that your analogies, your metaphors, your comparisons are to farmers market, local decentralized produce, quality, people being able to pick and choose for quality and so on, and rather than metaphors and comparisons with alcohol, tobacco, or pharmaceuticals.
That's important for another reason, Terrence, which is that the model that the Emerald Triangle farmers were implementing there in the Zip Tie program in Mendocino, it was long-term drawing board stuff. They weren't anywhere near implementing this yet, but their plan was to centralize parts of the process, the flower trimming, the harvesting, the testing to make sure what the levels of various cannabinoids, the chemical components in the plant, what those are, making sure there's no molds and mildews and pesticide residues in the plant. The plan was to do centralized facilities there that would really help local economies create jobs, and on top of that, take the unusable stalks and ferment them for locally derived energy. So there's a real chance for the cannabis economy to be the best or the worst world for the economy and the planet.
Okay. Again, the book is Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. It's just out in paperback. The website is Doug Fine, DougFine.com. And the book Too High to Fail So that you guys don't think it's all wonky analysis, is basically Doug Fine moved his family and himself to Mendocino for a year, and it's what he experienced and learned. And if you've been able to tell, Doug has kind of a zest for his writing, and so it's a fun book to read. Thank you, Doug Fine. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence. Keep up your great work. Appreciate
it. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or a world that just might work, a world that just might work, all one word, .com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues and 3 or 4 articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally at Mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.